Good evening, friends and brethren. Good to see you. If you would go with me to the book of Luke, chapter 14. Luke, chapter 14. The passage we will consider tonight is, again, one that is not unfamiliar to us. But as I was reading through this week and considering our reading, I kind of got stuck here a little bit. It was one that just kind of stood in my mind. This point about Jesus saying you have to count the cost. It's something that I'm afraid in a spiritual realm that all do not do. In the physical realm, we understand the need of counting the cost. But Jesus is placing the emphasis on the spiritual side of counting the cost, that there is a cost of discipleship. Jesus had been teaching in and around Jerusalem, and I'm not exactly sure where he is at this point in the Bible story, but it seems as though it was somewhere perhaps not far from Jerusalem. And as we come to this point of the record, Jesus had healed many. He had spoken very plainly just in the previous verses to the Pharisees. And he had taught by parables. And in chapter 15, he teaches by parable again, like three times. But he speaks here in the middle of all of this about counting the cost. And I'm thinking that there are some events here that led up to this that would cause him to be speaking now about counting the cost. The cost. When we go to the store, we look at the price of things because we're concerned about the cost. I do, and I suspect most of us do that. You go to buy a new car, you're looking at the sticker, the first thing. What does this thing cost? Because that's something that it resonates with us. It's important. Because we understand and realize that anything of value comes at a price. There is a price that has to be paid. And that is, we have to give something for it. And some things that we might buy, the cost is such that we have to think a while on that. I've told the kids a number of times, Daddy, can we buy this? No, I need to study on that a while, is what I would say. You've got to think about that. About 25 years ago, Sandra and I bought a stereo. It was a nice stereo. We'd wanted a really nice stereo. It was $425, I remember. That doesn't seem like a lot of money now, does it? But it was a lot of money to us at that time. We had to save a while because, I mean, I wasn't going to buy it on credit. I don't do that. And so we had to save a while till I had the cash, and I knew what I wanted, and we had the cash, went to the store, and I bought that. And we've still got it, and you've probably seen it. It looks pretty ancient now, but 25 years ago, it was uptown. We had to count the cost. And it had a lot of value to us, still has some value to us, because there was some sacrifice that was involved to buy that. And in fact, we were willing to even sacrifice some other things so that we could save to buy that thing. We had to make some choices along the way so that we could afford to buy that. We equate value to cost. And that's just our way of thinking about things. And I suppose we're not new in that because that's the analogies that Jesus uses here about counting the cost. So, I mean, that must be something that has always resonated with people, that you had to count the cost of certain things. But it's the way Jesus says some things in this text that's always been somewhat perplexing to me. Let me just say, you have to hate your father and mother. That's always just troubled me. I think there's a little more to it as far as the way of explanation, but that has always just struck me as peculiar. I think there's a reason for that. I mean, he is making a point of emphasis here. Luke 14, verse 25. And there went a great multitude with him. And he turned and said to them, if anyone comes to me and does not hate his father and mother, his wife and children, brothers and sisters, yes, his own life also, he cannot be my disciple. That's always just got me. And again, reading through this week, it kind of stopped me again, and I thought, okay, this is it. This is Sunday night right here. And I've been thinking about it all week. And wow, it's just such a powerful point. A man must hate his father. Now, what is Jesus really saying? Is he saying that we have to well up in our heart and have hate? Hatred against our father and our mother? Wait a minute. I'm remembering the Bible teaching us that there has to be honor for mother and father. I'm remembering Scripture that is telling us that a man must love his wife as Christ loved the church. So what does he mean when he says you have to hate? Well, Ray said something this morning. He touched on this point too, and I thought he hit this right. The idea of hate here being that of loving less. Even the point here about you have to hate yourself, and yet the apostle would say that you have to love yourself in Ephesians chapter 5. You know, one other passage that comes to mind with this, if you look with me back to the book of Genesis, we step out of our text here for just a moment and go to the book of Genesis chapter 29. We find, I think, sort of some similar verbiage that's used here. And we're kind of stepping into the story here of Jacob, and he marries Leah and Rachel. You know, it was Leah that was given to him first, but that's not the one that he thought he was working for. You remember the story. And he wasn't any too pleased about that, but in time, Laban gave him the daughter of Jacob's choosing, which was Rachel. But anyway, in Genesis 29 and in verse 30, I'm just stepping into this right here, it says, Jacob lay with Rachel also, because after he was given Rachel, and he loved Rachel much more than Leah. I mean, one conclusion I'm going to draw is he loved Leah, but he loved Rachel more in reading the text. He loved Rachel more than Leah. And he worked for Laban another 7 years. Verse 31. When the Lord saw that Leah was not loved. Okay, now some version, King James, New King James, I think says hated. Unloved. Okay, some says unloved. Depends what version here. Here we see that Leah was not loved. He opened her womb, but Rachel was barren. You know, it's kind of the same sense in which Jesus is using the term, I think, in Luke chapter 14. I think Jesus is trying to make the point here is that we're going to have to make a choice. Who is it that we love the most? And this kind of sets up the text here of what he is sharing with us here in this passage. You know, that we must love Jesus more than father or mother or brother or sister or wife or sons or daughters or even more than self. That what becomes a priority to us is the things of Jesus. That becomes our priority in life. He goes on and makes another vivid example here, verse 27. Context is still the same. Verse 27, he says, "And whomever does not bear his cross and come after me cannot be my disciple." Well, what is this supposed to mean, who does not bear his cross? I mean, Jesus is using a metaphor about a cross, I think in part because they would understand that soon, that Jesus was going to be an incredible illustration of what it means to have to bear up, you know, some difficulties and strife. You know, this does not, I don't think, really has anything to do with Jesus going to the cross. They could not go to the cross in the way that Jesus was, but that Jesus would illustrate what it means to take up a cross. But they already understood what that meant. Not with Jesus, because Jesus hadn't died yet. And they didn't fully understand what Jesus was going to do, but they understood the point of bearing up a cross. Because they would have all understood crucifixion. Because the Romans were, I mean, they were prolific at this point in time in using crucifixion. And part of the, and we've talked about this some with Jesus. You know, part of the shame even of having to go to the cross was having to bear your cross and carry or drag it even to the point of crucifixion. That you would have to carry that in front of others who would see and know where you were going and that you were being punished. And so when Jesus said to them that whoever does not bear his cross and come after me cannot be my disciple, imagine the pictures that they were conjuring up in their mind. There was a price to be paid. Just like one who was being crucified and had to carry their cross was paying a price for something they had done. And that seems to be the idea here, the connotation that comes to my mind in this. You know, just like a disciple will have to be willing to hate his own life or love himself less than Christ, even willing to accept crucifixion. So we're getting some pictures in our mind here of what this is. That the meaning seems to be more in the line of having, again, to count the cost. I mean, what if to be a disciple of Christ we literally had to go to the cross? Well, some did, actually, in the latter part of the first century. Or metaphorically, that on behalf of God's cause, that we must be willing to bear persecutions or troubles and distress. That there is a cost involved in being a disciple. That was our cross to bear. Sometimes we use that phrase that way sometimes, don't we? Or we know people that do. When someone is having to face some difficulties, we say, well, that's their cross to bear in life. And what we mean by that is that they're facing some difficulties. They have a load to carry. That maybe even there is a cost that they're having to pay, so to speak, for something that's been done or something they want to do. That's sort of the way that we would sometimes use that today. And again, I think the idea of bearing a cross for Christ was something that would be understood better in time. When Christians would, as we can, recall the fate of Christ and the spirit in which he encountered the crucifixion and he bore the cross, he paid a price. And that seems to be part of the idea that Jesus was wanting to put forth here. There is a price to pay. And part of why I'm thinking in these terms is because of what he says in the next few verses. It helps me, at least, to get a better understanding of what he means in these two verses when I look at the verses that follow. In fact, I'm not sure that I would understand what I'm trying to explain to you were it not for the verses that follow. Because as we read on just a little bit, verse 28, "For which of you intending to build a tower does not sit down first and count the cost, whether he has enough to finish it? Lest after he has laid the foundation and is not able to finish it, all who see it begin to mock him, saying, 'This man began to build and was not able to finish.' Or what king, going to make war against another king, does not sit down first and consider whether he is able with 10,000 to meet him who comes against him with 20,000? Or else, while the other is still a great way off, he sends a delegation and asks conditions of peace. So likewise, whoever of you does not forsake all that he has, he cannot be my disciple." See, the context is where we started. It's about counting the cost. Jesus is saying it in different ways. In some ways, to me, are somewhat obscure. Carrying the cross. I'm struggling to understand that. You have to hate father and mother and brother. Okay. Struggling to kind of get a grasp of what he means by that. But it's connected to this. It's connected to this part here that you have to count the cost. And then he uses some analogies here that I get. If you're going to build a house, you better see if you have enough money to finish it. You better figure that out. Growing up, there was this one place we drove going through a little town on the way to church where there was two or three buildings, a house and a couple of buildings that for years stood unfinished. I mean, the walls were there and there were roofs on, but there were no windows. There was nothing finished inside. For years they stood that way. I imagine they finally fell down at some point. And I can remember when I was small saying to my dad, "Daddy, when are they going to finish those houses?" And I remember him saying, "I don't expect they will at this point. They've sat that way for so long, you know." And I said, "Well, why?" He says, "I suppose they ran out of money." And I guess that is what happened. I really don't know. But you know, funny how that's always just stood with me. They ran out of money. They couldn't finish it. They started, but they couldn't finish it. You know, and they didn't count the cost. When Sandra and I were building the second house we built, we had sold our house. We had moved into a mobile home there on the farm. We put a mobile home there. We're going to live in that for a year until we built the house. And just a few months after we moved in that, much to the dissatisfaction of the girls, I would say, Hurricane Katrina hit down in New Orleans. And there was like a loud vacuum sound at all of the lumber supply places in our area. And there was like, the lumber just went away. And when lumber came back, I priced it pretty close. It was 30% higher. Not just lumber, but all building materials was 30% higher. Well, I had to do some figuring. And I didn't have to get very far into that, and I said, "We can't build this house." I said, "Well, we can build it, but we'll never come out from under it." I said, "Well, we can't build it." And so we built the house 3 years later. So we stayed in that mobile home for 3.5 years, you know, and it was all right. Counting the cost, that you have to think some of those things through sometimes. And what Jesus is talking about, you know, that you have to, you know, if you start something like that, but then you can't finish it, people are going to laugh at you, is what he's saying. You know, we see the folly, the foolishness of some who say that they will do something but have no means to finish it up because they haven't thought that through. Or maybe on the other hand, here's another point. Maybe with some, there's no real plan or intention to complete it. A lot of people talk big, and they can even start big. But some people, it seems, have never finished anything they start. Have you noticed that? I think there's a point of application with that that may come here as well. And all I'm saying about that is many disciples have started their walk with the Lord, but haven't lasted very long. We have some here that just need some constant help and encouragement, and some that I think we're just going to lose. Because as they get into a walk with the Lord, they're realizing more and more that there's a cost involved here. You know, there is a cost to walk with the Lord. And it's painful to me to see new disciples who do not finish their walk with the Lord. And we've all seen that. It's like some become, or treat becoming a Christian with carelessness and with light concern. Maybe not realizing the sacrifices that come with it. And I don't suppose there's any way that you can know or fully understand all that's involved in being a Christian when you start that walk. But isn't that what Jesus is trying to tell these disciples? That this is not easy. And you have to count the cost. And he uses analogies that we can get, that we have to hate father, mother, brother, and sister, that we have to love Jesus more. That if you're going to build a house, you better see if you have enough money. If you're a king and you're going to go to war, you better figure this out if you can win or not. You have to count the cost of these things. And the cost of failure, is tremendous. You know, if we start a house and we can't finish it, the cost of failure may be, well, it may be bruised pride, because people will laugh at us. Well, that's bad enough, but that doesn't compare at all to starting our walk with Christ. But we finish part way. That's much more dramatic. 2 Peter chapter 2. Here's another one of those passages that kind of sticks out in my mind because it's kind of grotesque. But it makes a really powerful point. Peter is trying to encourage these Christians here to not lose what they have, to not lose the hope of salvation that they have in Jesus Christ. Don't be fooled, he's saying. Don't be fooled by the destructive doctrines that are all around, the false teachers and the false prophets and the false apostles. And he's concerned about that, and he says, don't be deceived. 2 Peter 2, verse 20. For if after they have escaped the pollutions of the world through the knowledge of the Lord and Savior Jesus Christ, they are again entangled in them and overcome, the latter end is worse for them than the beginning. For it would have been better for them not to have known the way of righteousness than after they have known it to turn from the holy commandment delivered to them. But it has happened to them, according to the true proverb, the dog returns to his own vomit, and the sow that has washed to her wallowing in the mire. That's what leaving the Lord is like. And we read that and we go, that's grotesque. That's horrible. Yes, it is. So is leaving the Lord. When we've not counted the cost, when we have not considered what is involved in walking with Him, or even greater, the greater picture is we've not considered what it is to not walk with Him, becomes the more powerful point. In our text again, Luke 14, the last two verses of the chapter, we're still in the same context, it hasn't changed. And Jesus kind of finishes up this point of teaching by saying, salt is good, but if the salt has lost its flavor, how shall it be seasoned? It is neither fit for the land nor for the dunghill, but men throw it out. He who has ears to hear, let him hear. It seems to me that salt stands for the spirit of self-sacrifice. That's the context. Counting the cost. Being willing to sacrifice of self to walk with the Lord. Salt represents the disciples who would count the cost or pay the price. Those who were unwilling to do this were worthless. It's like salt that loses its flavor. Tasteless salt, can you imagine? I mean, how much salt would you want in your salt shaker that you put out and it doesn't change the flavor at all? It would not take us long to say, well, that's just worthless. That's no good at all. Indeed. That's what Jesus is saying. That the disciples that lose their flavor, so to speak, they become worthless. It would be of no value. Salt without flavor would be of no value. You know, it's interesting that Jesus, in another time in Matthew's account, it was a different account than this one right here we're reading about, but in Matthew chapter 5, you remember again when Jesus used salt in his analogy here? Matthew chapter 5, you look there with me. Matthew chapter 5, verse 13, we begin. Speaking to his disciples, he says, you are the salt of the earth. But if the salt loses its flavor, how shall it be seasoned? It is then good for nothing but to be thrown out and trampled underfoot by men. You are the light of the world. A city that is set on a hill cannot be hidden, nor do they light a lamp and put it under a basket, but on a lampstand. And it gives light to all who are in the house. Let your light so shine before men that they may see your good works and glorify your Father who is in heaven. So Jesus is saying to those disciples, and he's saying to us, you are the salt of the earth. You give flavor to what is tasteless. You give flavor to the earth. Flavor the world in a good way. But if the salt, that which is to make us stand out, if we lose that flavor, if we become tasteless, so to speak, what is it that would make us stand out from the world? Nothing. We are meant to stand out. Salt is good, but if salt loses its flavor, how shall it be seasoned? It's not even good for the dunghill, back in our text. Jesus is saying, count the cost. That we are supposed to stand out. Not in a way that's bringing any recognition to us, but because we are disciples of Christ, because we have counted the cost, because we have made a choice to be different. We have made a choice to take on the flavor that the Lord would want us to have, or to be the light of the world, as he said in Matthew's account over here. But if we lose that flavor, what benefit are we to the kingdom? See, we're back to this point again of counting the cost and being willing to leave all to follow Christ. In the fuller context of the text we've read, I think that's the point. I think that's the idea, that we have to be willing to count the cost and make a choice to give, to have something of value. We have to give ourselves. That's the price. We have to give ourselves to have that which is of value. To be considered the child of God, to be a disciple of Jesus Christ, that is of great value. And we don't want to give that up, but to count the cost. We're singing a song as we close tonight. Earl reminded me, we just sang this last week or the week before, but I asked him, would he mind doing it again? Because when I was reading this text, this is what came to mind. Maybe it's because we just did it a week ago is why it came to mind. But really, it's a song that helps to bring about the idea of counting the cost. And it's an interesting progression here that I hope we are all trying to make, or maybe we've made it. You know, when we are at a point in life where we think more of self, we think more of self even than we do of the Lord. And we may say the difference. We may say, no, the Lord is number one. But sometimes if we're honest and we look at our lives, we may see that we've just not given ourselves over fully to Him. And sometimes we have to learn that, don't we? And the song, it starts out with this idea of the bitter pain and sorrow that a time could ever be when I proudly said to Jesus, all of self and none of thee. And maybe we can look back in a time in our life where that was a description of us, where we were more in tune with our interests and needs than we were the Lord's. And maybe our interests and needs is all that was on our mind. But maybe in time, yet He found me. I beheld Him bleeding on the accursed tree. And my wistful heart said faintly, some of self and some of thee. Where we've made a little turn in our thinking and in our understanding, and we're starting to see the value of Jesus and the less worth that we find in our life. And then the time where we go day by day, His tender mercy, healing, helping, full and free, brought me lower while I whispered, less of self and more of thee. Praise God, when we come to a point where we realize that everything of value at all is what is found in Jesus Christ, when we give ourselves to Him wholly and completely, where hopefully and prayerfully one day we say, higher than the highest heavens, deeper than the deepest sea, Lord, Thy love at last has conquered none of self and all of Thee. Have we counted the cost? What it is and what it means to be a servant of Jesus Christ, where we are willing to give all of self to Him. If we need to make changes in our lives, if we need to respond and become a child of God tonight, here is an opportunity. Would you come as we stand and sing?